Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And today we continue in our study of the Magi and the Star of Bethlehem. Now, I warned you at Thanksgiving that this would be an ongoing holiday special, and I did mention Easter to you, didn't I? This is our Easter special. It goes back to Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's and Martin Luther King Jr. and Valentine's, the spring equinox. Now Easter. Next up is opening day. Thank you, Jesus. I want to make an announcement that Danny Hunt and Colleen, is she not here? She's with the baby. There's been a new spawn. And by the way, I can never remember the last name.
It's Gessling.
Gessling. Yes, I know that part. Gessling is what I can remember. Megan and Pat Gessling. And they have a new daughter named Madison Elizabeth. She weighed in at 6 pounds and 13 ounces. No other stats. They're still measuring. So congratulations to them and to you, and Danny and Colleen and Kathleen and Casey and Megan, his parents. We left off in our study after having examined quite a number of things regarding the Magi. We took a look at our first grouping of constellations that we will be noting. And we noted Virgo. And then Pisces and Leo completed that study, and a few little minor points need to be wrapped up before we move on. For those of you who have not been here for this study, you're only like 6 months behind. But there are MP3s, and you can catch up to speed over the course of the next couple of months. And I think that they're in the bookcase in the room adjacent to the right. We need to resume by noting that what we've just studied is the general understanding that the Magi had of the heavens during the time of the virgin pregnancy and the virgin birth of Jesus. They had this understanding because they were astronomers. Their job was to observe the skies. And we're going to note in our upcoming study today, and we'll continue into next Sunday, how the science of astronomy was probably one of the first sciences. There's a reason for me saying that. It could be the very first. And there are reasons to make that claim, and we'll make note of it as we move through. But the Magi were experts. They were scientists. They were not involved in astrology. That's an evil contortion, satanically motivated, of astronomy. And as we continue in our study, you'll see why Lucifer had to get involved in this, because the creation itself is a testimony not only to the grace of God, but the salvation plan of God. And when you understand that, you'll have a greater appreciation for the universe. The science of today is trying to contort and distort the creation of God. If you will go to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and you will note the creation verb there, Bereshith bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created, and bara is equal to katizo in the Greek and to ex nihilo in the Latin, all three of which mean to create something out of no pre-existing materials. It was the Word of God that spoke the universe into existence, and it was up and running. God does not need a process. He does not need an evolutionary period of time to bring things into existence. He has created it as is. And the things that science observes that confuses them and they have to cook up formulae in order to explain them simply expresses the fact that they're humans and do not have the perspicacity to understand the creation of a perfect God of the universe, who is, by the way, Jesus Christ, according to Colossians 1, 16 and 17. I once ran into a lady back at the first church who was confused over the fact of theophanies. How can Jesus Christ be appearing in the Old Testament when he wasn't born until the New Testament? And it had to be explained to her, do you not understand that Jesus Christ is undiminished deity and true humanity in one person forever? Do you not understand that he is the creative agent of the universe, Colossians 1, 16 and 17, and that he has always existed? There's never been a time when he did not exist. That's why we say God in three persons, blessed Trinity. He is the second person of the Trinity, and in his deity has always existed. There will never be a time when he did not exist. He, therefore, was the agent of creation. And when he did it, the things that you see in the night sky, those things you can see, were created by him, up and running. And when we get through with this study, you're going to have a greater appreciation of the things that are available to you simply by looking up. And you will understand to a greater degree of appreciation who and what our Lord is. These magi were scientists. They were not astrologers. They were astronomers. It was the first science. And it was the first because Jesus Christ taught it to them. These men were students of the stars. And they had a clear understanding of the repetitiveness of the cycles evident in the movement of the planets and the Earth's relation to the fixed stars stationed along its ecliptic, forming the 12 constellation carousel. Here is the 12 constellation carousel. You probably can't see it. It doesn't matter. There are 12 of them, 12 categories. They're in a 30-degree segment, each of them. The ones that we have been highlighting are Virgo, which is number one in the process of revealing the plan of God through the stars. The second that we note is Pisces, because it is directly related to the nation Israel. And the last one in the story is Leo, the conquering lion of the millennial kingdom. And we're going to work our way through this. Now, these guys in the back are dousing the lights for my advantage, leaving these on so I can see. But these visuals that you're about to see are taken from Starry Night Pro computer program, where I can drill back in time. And you can see here we're looking at the night skies in Pisces on the 29th of May of 7 B.C. at 4:10 in the morning. And these things become pertinent to our study as we move forward. But just to show you, you could not see this with the lights on. So there's nothing unusual about what happens within God's creation, since the movements of objects throughout the universe are in perfect synchronization by divine design. It is a clockwork operation. It runs like a well-oiled machine. You can go back in time because studies have been made of orbital mechanics. Kepler was involved in this, and he understood how orbits worked and developed formulas that express this. Once you plug that into the entire universe, you can predict exactly where things are going to be at any given time, on any given date, past, present, or future. And that's how we launch rockets and hit the moon and don't miss it. So these kinds of things express that I can go back in time and show you this diagram that will have meaning as we move through our study. So this is a process that we must understand has been developed by God in the beginning. It was perfect. It's in motion. It's his organization, and it's like a clock. However, man's observation, incidences do occur that seem rare. You look up in the sky, and things do occur there from our viewpoint seem rare. It was a combination of unusual simultaneous as well as sequential celestial events. Simultaneous and sequential celestial events taking place over a short period of time that have led some theologians to take note. Some have written their conclusions, which speculate these events are a possible explanation of what the Magi identified in Matthew 2:2 as his star. And it motivated them to organize a caravan to Jerusalem. That took a while to do, as we've noted, but they got organized and they brought thousands of people with them from Hecatompolis, Parthia, to Jerusalem. And therefore, their objective was to worship the Messiah of Israel. We've established the fact that the people of Parthia, and especially the Magi, were Jews as well as Gentiles. I gave you explanation of three major diaspora where the Jews were spread out throughout the Middle East, including the kingdoms of Persia, the Chaldeans. All of these people conquered Jews at one time, the Assyrians and so on. And therefore, they populated these areas, but they took their religion and their culture with them, and they evangelized the natives of those particular areas. And in the time of our Lord's birth, that area was known as the Parthian Empire. Therefore, these men were believers. They understood how to read the signs in the heavens, and they recognized a certain arrangement of heavenly bodies that clued them in that the Messiah of Israel had been born. Now, we will examine the writings of three men who take the approach that we've noted. First excerpt, we will consult the Star of Bethlehem, what is it? It's found in chapter 5 of Robert W. Fayed's A Scientific Approach to Biblical Mysteries. He'll be number one. Secondly, we will refer to the Star of Bethlehem, chapter 17 of Joseph A. Sice's The Gospel in the Stars. And finally, we will view Frederick A. Larson's documentary DVD, The Star of Bethlehem. We have to build a case, though, because there are quite a number of approaches to this. But once you analyze the heavens and get all of the facts in a row, there's only one answer. So paragraph 6 of our study, the views of the theologians regarding the celestial objects. Now, we have discussed the various celestial objects that were charted by the ancient astronomers. They included stars, constellations, planets, moons, meteors, and comets. But the general terms were Kokav in the Hebrew and Aster in the Greek. And the constellations were referred to in the Hebrew by the word Mazaroth. That is a word that comes to us from astrology as the zodiac. And I refuse to use that term unless it's found in the text that we might quote. I've changed Mazaroth to the carousel. If you've ever been on a merry-go-round, it goes around a central post, and those who stand to the side get sick, watching the up and down and the round and around and all that. My brain cannot handle that, so I turn my back on carousels, but merry-go-rounds. But this carousel goes around the North Pole. It repeats itself once a year, and if you understand what you're seeing, then you can be instructed on how to build a calendar, how to plant crops, how to harvest crops, these kinds of things. Also, it is the gospel message. So our first guy out is Robert W. Fayed. This man is not really a theologian. The only place I could get any detailed information about him was on Wikipedia, which I consider an untrustworthy site. Years ago down in Chesterfield, when Wikipedia was just out, I happened up on it and I quoted something off Wikipedia and found out it was wicked. And I don't trust it and haven't trust. But the only place I can find information on this guy is on Wikipedia, which I think is telling. Nevertheless, here's what it's got. Robert W. Fayed. By the way, you may be asking, why are you quoting this guy? Well, he actually has a logical conclusion. He's wrong, but it's logical. And I want you to see this. This old boy has lived from 1929 to 2008, when apparently up and died. He was an American author, numerologist. It's a little fuzzy there. There is such a thing as numerology, biblical numerology. Certain things stand for certain things. Seven is perfection, you know the drill. But there are people who take it way too far, so we try to avoid that. He was a former nuclear engineer from Greenville, South Carolina. He had a master's degree in theology from Coatesville Bible College. And Fayed was an agnostic in his early life, and he converted to Christianity after recovery from cancer. Now, Bob, as he's called here, went to serve his country in the United States Army during the end of World War II and later in the Korean conflict. He was one of the first airborne rangers. He graduated with a degree in engineering from Johns Hopkins University and began a 25-year career with W.R. Grace & Company, from which he retired in 1973. Mr. Faid was not only a Christian American author as a nuclear engineer, Robert held the honor of being one of the top 10 nuclear scientists until 1975. He also held a degree in theology from Coatesville Bible College and was a faithful member of the Greenville First Church of the Nazarene. That's all I can tell you about him. I searched the web. I cannot find a college called Coatesville Bible. He's apparently deep into numerology and other spurious ideas. Well, nevertheless, he did write a book. And there are a few books out there on the Star of Bethlehem that are worth reading. And he did write this book, and I mentioned his conclusions illustrate an attaboy effort. He did give it a good go. So he winds up with no cigar, though, but we're going to take a look at what he says, because in the process of taking a look at Faid and then our next guy down the line, Sice, we're going to learn a lot about the constellations and some of the belief systems that are involved in how to read the constellations. And as we gain that inventory of ideas when we get to our final story, then you'll have some knowledge and some vocabulary. So here we go with Faid. He makes the statement, rather, what the Magi saw in the sky. Now, I'm going to read what he's got here, but I want you to know that by the time we get through, I'm going to tell you that he missed it. What had the Magi seen in the heavens which led them to come seeking this newborn babe who was to be a king? To answer that, we must remember that almost 600 years before, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar had taken the Hebrews captive back to his kingdom. That's one of the three major diaspora we've noted. In 538 B.C., Babylon had been conquered by the Persians and the Medes, and Cyrus had allowed the Hebrews to return to their own land. And you can see that in 2 Chronicles 36, verses 22 through 23, and in the book of Ezra, chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. Now, not all of the Hebrews chose to return to Judea, however. In fact, less than 50,000 Hebrews elected to return. The vast majority stayed in the area which had been Babylon, and where they had established homes and shops, businesses, raised their children and grandchildren, and felt safe and secure. And so they stayed, and their culture and their languages stayed with them. These Magi knew, therefore, that Hebrews considered the constellation of Pisces as representing their own nation. You see the constellation Pisces on the board. This represents the nation Israel. The wandering star called Udi-Edim, which we know as the planet Saturn, designated the city of Jerusalem. That's in the eye of the Hebrews. Another wandering star, which the Babylonians call Mul-Babar, denoted royalty to the Hebrews, and we call that planet Jupiter. Now, what the Magi saw then was clear to them, and it involved the constellation of Pisces, the fish — it's really plural, it's the fishes — and the two planets, Saturn and Jupiter. And the Magi knew exactly what these signs in the sky meant to the Hebrews in Judea. Now he takes up signs in the sky. It began on the evening of May 29th of 7 B.C. That's what you see on the board. We can picture the Babylonian astronomers, their eyes fixed on the constellation of Pisces, where a rare event was taking place. The two wandering stars, Mul-Babar and Udi-Edim — that would be Jupiter and Saturn — they were coming together in the constellation of Pisces. Now, it seems to be very important when there's a conjunction of planets, and a conjunction means they seem to be running into each other. Literally, they do not. They're millions of miles apart. But from platform Earth, when you see the orbits cross, it appears in the moments that they're close that they may run into each other and may even merge for a moment, and then one will pass the other. But this conjunction within a specific constellation, namely Pisces, had meaning to these men. So we know that the planets Jupiter and Saturn were not actually coming together, but when viewed from the Earth, their orbits were crossing so that an observer would see them apparently merging together. Now, this conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter was not in itself amazing, but again, on the evening of October 3rd of 7 BC, these two planets seemed to come together in Pisces. So this is a second conjunction that occurred several months later. And when this happened a third time on December the 4th of 7 BC, we can guess that these men looked at one another in bewilderment. Three conjunctions of these two planets in the same constellation, namely Pisces, was considered to be an attention-getting message. It's not unusual for these planets to conjunct, but to do it three times over the period of about 9 months is quite unusual. And so that caught their attention. And so they had to ask the question, what do these things mean? Were these strange events announcing something? They could calculate that once every 804 years, there would be a single conjunction of these wandering stars, but three times in a single year. That was unusual. Now note that these men had the ability to realize and to understand and to compute that this kind of conjunction was normal every 804 years. But within a 9-month period, it had occurred three times. So that was something that caught their attention. So this was indeed a very unusual series of signs in the sky. Their wonder grew as in the spring of 6 BC an even rarer event took place. Now, I don't have a slide for that because Starry Night Pro doesn't show what I'm about to tell you. Again, in the constellation of Pisces, there was a conjunction, but this time of three wandering stars, Jupiter, Saturn, were joined by Mars. And this man writes, it was in the spring of 6 BC. I went day by day, beginning with March the 21st, which is the opening day of spring, all the way to June 21st, which is the opening day of summer, and such a conjunction or an accumulation never occurred. Nevertheless, that's what he says. And so the astronomers, he goes on, perhaps look back on the series of events trying to understand what these signs could mean. Now, we're disproving this, guys, as we move through here. That conjunction did not occur. Maybe one of them recalled that Pisces was the constellation denoting the nation of the Hebrews. Another may have added that one of these conjunctions, namely the event of October 3rd of 7 B.C., that's right there, had taken place on what the Jews called the Day of Atonement. That would be Yom Kippur. Another may have remembered that Edim was the star of the city of Jerusalem, and they all knew, of course, that Mul Babar meant royalty, namely Jupiter. And that was it. There was going to be a king born in Judea of the Hebrews. That had to be the meaning, it is imputed these men as assuming, but they would wait for another sign. That did not come until the following year. They could calculate the conjunctions of the wandering stars. They could predict eclipses of both the sun and moon. But what happened in July of 5 BC, they could in no way have expected. Suddenly, in the constellation of Aquila, the eagle, a new star blazed, brighter than any in the sky. In fact, it was so bright that it could be seen even in the daytime. This had to be the sign that they were waiting for. This brilliant new star must be the announcement of the birth of the King of the Jews. All right. That comes from Robert W. Faeds, A Scientific Approach to Biblical Mysteries. A new star. Brand new. Really. The new star described by Faed is known as a nova. There's nothing new about a nova. It too is a star. In fact, it consists of two stars that are going through dramatic changes. A description of these changes is provided by this article on the website of the American Association of Variable Star Observers. Now, I've got the diagram on the board, and I tried to put it in your notes. For those of you who don't have notes, you can look on the board. But what you see is an artist's conception of a white dwarf pulling material from its companion star. So this is what is called a binary arrangement, meaning two stars very close together. This is the giant on the left in yellow. It is bigger than the star to the right. In the middle of the star to the right, you have a white dot in the middle, and that's called a white dwarf. Now, it has tremendous gravitational pull, and it begins to draw material from the giant over to itself. And as this orbits around the white star, certain events begin to take place, and I'd like to describe those to you. You need to understand what a nova is. A nova is singular. Novae is plural. Nova has to do with two stars, binaries. One giant, one smaller, with a white dwarf center. Here we go. Cataclysmic variables are a diverse group of binary variable stars composed of a white dwarf primary and a giant secondary star. The stars orbit closely enough about one another that mass is transferred from the secondary star to the white dwarf. Since that process of mass transfer can generate lots of energy, it is what makes them vary, that meaning in brightness. And that variability can be cataclysmic, in that these stars can sometimes get considerably brighter in a very short period of time. What makes the class so diverse is how quickly mass transfer progresses and what happens to the matter when it gets to the white dwarf. The word nova is used for many of these stars because one of their behaviors is to suddenly brighten, sometimes from telescopic invisibility to obvious naked eye brightness. You get that? It'd be invisible even through a telescope, and suddenly it appears. And therefore, the Magi of old may have looked at that and said it's a new star. So when this happens, they can briefly appear as a, quote, new star or nova stella in the sky, hence the name. But nova is used for a very broad range of behavior. Three commonly discussed types are dwarf novae, classical novae, and recurrent novae. Now, these classes differ in two ways. The reason for their sudden light increase and the amount by which they brighten. The much more common dwarf novae brighten because the matter flow being accreted, meaning sucked off or drawn away, from the secondary to the white dwarf can at somewhat random intervals get hotter. And when it gets hotter, it gets much, much brighter. A dwarf nova outburst can increase the luminosity of these binary systems by a factor of 100 or more for several days or weeks, until the accretion disk around the white dwarf can cool down again. And this repeats again and again, taking anywhere from a few days to a few years, depending on the star. The classical novae are quite a bit more spectacular. When they go into outburst, they can brighten by a factor of 10,000 or more. They still accrete matter like dwarf novae do, but in the classical novae, the matter that piles up on the white dwarf's surface gets hotter and denser over time and eventually undergoes thermonuclear reaction. These stars are like giant thermonuclear bombs, temporarily flaring up with the brightness of 10,000 suns. Now get this. The light curves of individual novae vary, but typically they brighten from telescopic invisibility over the course of many hours to a day or two, reach a peak, and then fade away to telescopic invisibility over times ranging from days to several months, perhaps never to be seen as novae again, at least not in our lifetime. And then finally we have recurrent novae, which is an exclusive club. The recurrent novae are like classical novae in that they consist of a white dwarf primary star accreting mass from a stellar secondary. accreted material builds up on the white dwarf and eventually reaches the temperature and pressure required for thermonuclear ignition. And when it does, the shell of accreted material undergoes thermonuclear fusion, rapidly increasing the brightness of the system and ejecting its shell of material off the surface of the white dwarf. Where recurrent novae differ from the classical novae is that they repeat on observable timescales. Classical novae are not thought to repeat for hundreds or thousands of years at the very least, but recurrent novae can recur on timescales of years or decades. It is possible that there are not two classes of novae, but rather a continuum of recurrence times. However, the recurrent novae as a group also have higher mass accretion rates than classical novae on average. Spectroscopic evidence seems to suggest that the secondaries in recurrent novae are all giant stars. The weaker surface gravitates of a giant secondary star would make it easier for the white dwarf primaries to pull material off. The short recurrence time also suggests that the white dwarf primary must be closer to the, now I'll try to do this, Chandrasekhar limit. That's defined below for the people in the aquarium. They know this, and they get me the pronunciation at halftime. But here we go. The Chandrasekhar limit is an important value in astrophysics. It is the mass limit at which a non-rotating astral body cannot be supported by the pressure of the electron shells in its atoms anymore, and gravitational collapse occurs. And then there's a formula. So, the short recurrence time also suggests that the white dwarf primary must be closer to the Chandrasekhar limit for recurrent novae simply because their stronger surface gravities are better able to compress the accreted hydrogen to thermonuclear fusion pressure and temperatures sooner following a nova outburst. It can happen over and over again. Now, that was way above my head. It was way above yours, possibly. But what we find out from that excerpt is this, is that there is such a thing as, quote, a new star, something that's not there, never been seen before, and suddenly it is seen. And then after a short period of time, it goes away. And then later on, after another short period of time, a month, maybe a year, it can therefore become visible again. And that would be a nova. Now, what Fiad suggests as being the Star of Bethlehem is conceivable. Novae are not visible to the naked eye until thermonuclear explosions cause their brightness to dramatically increase. Suddenly, a new star, previously invisible, can appear within the boundaries of a given constellation. For example, as we've noted, in the case of a dwarf nova, the process of coming and going in and out of brightness can be repeated over a period of months or years. Fiad did not address the Magi's lost sight of the star while in Parthia, followed by its reappearance upon their leaving Jerusalem for Bethlehem. He didn't even address that. Could have, but didn't. But a nova would provide a reasonable explanation for such a phenomenon. This is apparently what our next theologian concludes as well. His name is Joseph A. Seiss, and we'll see what he's got to say, for those of you who stay, in the second session, time for tea and crumpets.